You're listening to a podcast from Meaning of Life TV.
Hi, John.
Hi there, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm very well. Nice to be on your show this morning.
Nice to have you. I'm really excited about this conversation. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via any audio podcast app. And you are John Kabat-Zinn, well-known to many people. And I want to say why I'm so excited about talking to you. You know, mindfulness, as you certainly know, has become a big word in America. A lot of people do mindfulness meditation. And then a lot of people, I think, kind of carry around with them a kind of philosophy of mindfulness, whether they do the meditation or not.
Yeah.
And I honestly think you're probably too humble to agree that, you know, if you started listing people who are most responsible for the prevalence of the word mindfulness, you could certainly make a case that you are more responsible than anyone else. There might be other candidates, but you could make a good case.
And, I know a lot of other candidates.
Well, okay, fine. But I want to make the case for you. You don't have to. You can sit there humbly shaking your head. Feel free. I just want to quickly make the case for you. The term mindfulness-based stress reduction is your term. A lot of people have become aware of mindfulness kind of through that vehicle. This is something that's taught at a lot of places in a therapeutic context. And that's what's interesting is that although mindfulness, as you certainly know, is a term that originates in Buddhism, very ancient term. That is elaborated on in very ancient texts. A lot of people now first encounter mindfulness in this more therapeutic and you might say secular setting. And I'll tell you, what has made me aware of how important that is this book I wrote, Why Buddhism is True, which you were kind enough to have a conversation with me about in Louisville, Kentucky, at the Kentucky Authors Forum a few months ago. It was only after I published that book that I realized that there are a lot of institutional settings in which mindfulness is taught and a lot of institutional settings in which I would like to see mindfulness taught. And it can only be taught in these places if it is separated from the word Buddhism as a practical matter, because it's like, you know, although you and I know that you can talk about mindfulness in the context of Buddhist philosophy without bringing in what you might call the religious parts of Buddhism, rebirth and everything else. It certainly, there is this naturalistic yet Buddhist version of mindfulness that we can talk about, and that's the kind I talk about. But the fact is that if you're trying to convince a public school board to teach mindfulness in the public schools, you really should leave the word Buddhism out, because some of them will find it threatening because it sounds religious. It sounds incompatible with their own religious teachings, whatever. So that's my big discovery about why what you've done is so important. And yet you yourself, of course, came upon this in a Buddhist context. I want to talk about that in your whole history. But first of all, is this consonant with your experience that for certain purposes, mindfulness needs to really be separated from the word Buddhism?
Yeah, I would say that there are several different ways to look at this, and it's kind of an ongoing unfolding that has something to do with the evolution of the species that you write about so beautifully in the book you mentioned, Why Buddhism is True. So let me just back up for a second and say that I really recognize, and thank you for, you know, expressing those sentiments about my role in some sense, you could say, the flowering of this within the mainstream world. And I, you know, accept that in the sense that it was actually my intention from the very beginning, when I started MBSR, Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center Hospital, you know, 40 years ago next year, it was very much for that purpose, to actually bring the heart of Buddhist meditative practice into the mainstream of the world, not so much in a secular way, although I used to use that word, but I shy away from it more and more.
I'm not wild about the word in this context either.
Right. And the reason being that, and we can get into this more if you like in the conversation, that in the particular kind of framework in which I teach, the kind of non-dual approach to meditative awareness is extremely important. And when you latch onto a word like secular, you're immediately creating the dualism between there's the sacred and the secular. And I'm not willing to abandon whatever we mean when we use the word sacred, although other more religious words are obviously more loaded. So there's this sense that that from the beginning, the idea was to, and this is where the whole Buddhism question comes in that you were just asking about. There's a way of looking at Buddhism that that understands from the beginning that it's not about the ism, and it's not really entirely about religion, that it's more like a deep insight into the nature of humanity that a human being is said to have had, who was himself not a Buddhist, arguably, but just a person who was trying to use whatever resources he had at the time to understand the nature of two things, his own mind and also the nature of reality, using the instruments, his own mind and body at his disposal. So from that point of view, you could say that whatever we really mean by Buddhism when we're talking about this is actually and always has been universal. It has more to do with the nature of the human mind and body and world than it has to do with a particular philosophy or religion or even psychology that is limited to people who have a faith relationship to that religion. Mm-hmm. So that to me is already extremely interesting. This is also true in a certain way for Taoism. And these have very, very ancient roots in Asia. And as you know, I mean, I had been practicing, for years before I decided to start the clinic, because I'd been asking myself since I was like very young, what is my job on the planet with a capital J? In other words, it may sound very privileged, but what would I love so much that I would pay to do it for work? And it wasn't molecular biology, which was what I was being trained in at MIT.
You actually have a PhD in molecular biology, is that right?
Yeah, from with Salvador Luria, who was a right. Nobel laureate,
yeah.
And won the Nobel Prize while I was in his lab. Mm-hmm. And we would have these kinds of discussions about beyond molecular biology, the nature of reality. What are we really studying when we're asking questions about life and evolution and all of that? So for me, it was like, once I discovered meditation and yoga, and put them together in my own life and practiced with them for maybe 13 years, I began to realize that, you know, that like there are hundreds of my fellow graduate students going on to, you know, do work in molecular biology, but nobody's doing this stuff at the interface of, meditative awareness and science. And so it felt like, and the whole challenge of suffering and in the world. And so the question would be, well, where could you actually have the rubber meet the road in a way that might be skillful and valuable? In other words, if you were on the lookout for what I would call dukkha magnets, places that
dukkha being the Buddhist term for suffering, sometimes suffering with a connotation of kind of unsatisfactoriness, because exactly. the Buddhist idea is that a big part of suffering is the fact that we're never really satisfied with what we've got. We're always trying to get away from something or grab something or whatever. Yeah.
There's a certain, it literally in the Pali or Sanskrit refers to a wheel being out of kilter so that it never rolls completely true. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in the one way of framing it is like, if things are going great, there's an aspect of your own mind that's saying, well, this isn't going to last. But if things are horrible in your life, there's another aspect of mind that's not saying, well, this isn't going to last either, but exactly the opposite, that this is going to last forever. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain kind of asymmetry there, which is obviously wrong. And Buddhism, in some sense, is sort of framing that, like, how do we approach dukkha or the human domain of suffering in a way that has the potential to liberate us from that suffering, what they call sort of adventitious suffering, the way in which our own mind and perceptions and conditioning actually creates the suffering element of it. I mean, yes, you could have a disaster happen. I mean, you can have huge, you know, loss of various kinds, natural disasters, tsunamis, earthquakes. But the challenge is the suffering comes out of how you are in relationship to what unfolds rather than.
Wait, let me interject your book plugs for you, given that you used the word disaster. Your first big book was Full Catastrophe Living. And then your super bestseller was Wherever You Go, There You Are. And I want to talk later about that latter phrase in particular. But now go ahead.
So the point is basically that, to cut to the chase is that how to bring, the heart or the, you could say the essence without dilution and without ignoring all the other stuff, but the essence of it into the mainstream of the world, because it's not just Buddhists who are suffering. Everybody is suffering by nature of being human, and even other species are suffering. How can we deal with this whole question from the point of view of perhaps really deeply understanding what it means to be human, which if you want to use the word spiritual, which I always try to stay away from as much as I can, my working definition of the word spiritual would be what it means to be really human, and just leave it at that, because anybody could say anything about that.
I got to say, I like spiritual. I feel about spiritual kind of the way you feel about sacred, which is that the reason I don't like secular Buddhism is a lot of people think, oh, you mean it's not in any sense spiritual. But so anyway, you've got sacred, I've got spiritual, but
yeah,
I take your point that spiritual
kind of attachments to words.
Yeah. Yeah. I've used spiritual. I try to use spiritual with non-attachment, even though I like it.
Because you're very strong on emphasizing the sort of lack of essence of everything. And of course, words are pointing exactly
totally
to that. And so, we're stuck with the fact that we all have slightly different hits on it. And when I hear the word spiritual, usually I roll my eyes because it's got all this airy fairy romantic stuff associated with it. And I'm trying to sort of keep home to a kind of level of simplicity and clarity that, you know what I'm talking about, at least. So to make a long story short, as I said, in 1979, I started this clinic in the Department of Medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center that was a kind of pilot test of whether we could create a clinic in the form of an 8-week long course that would be designed to catch people who are suffering, falling through the cracks of the healthcare system, if you will, with every conceivable medical and even psychiatric diagnosis imaginable, and challenge them in a certain way. And that is there something on this planet that might be valuable for you that nobody else can do for you? That's something that you could train in and learn by yourself in the context of a course in a hospital that might complement whatever healthcare was able to do for your chronic heart disease, for your chronic pain, for your chronic this or that. And if you're interested, let's just see. Empirically, throw ourselves into it. This will involve fairly intensive and rigorous Buddhist meditation training, and I would say without the Buddhism, just so that they were clear. I mentioned Buddhism right from the start because, you know, they're going to find out sooner or later, so I'd rather, like, nip that in the bud and just say that this is Buddhism in some sense without the Buddhism, which from a non-dual point of view might be the true Buddhism. So all these things are kind of fungible or arguable. And the point was to just see, to get started and empirically see whether you could take people who had no interest in meditation, no interest in Buddhism, no interest necessarily in some kind of spirituality or what they might think of as New Age mysticism, and just see what would happen if we started training them in mindfulness, which for people who are listening and don't know, my working definition of it is that mindfulness is basically awareness. Okay. So it's not something that you need to get. It's something that we all already have intrinsically, but access to it is not so great because we're almost always plagued by this other fantastic quality of being human, which is that we think a lot and we're very emotional a lot about what we think. So we never sort of feature in our education this other form of intelligence that we're born with, namely the capacity to hold things in awareness, including our thoughts and emotions.
Right. And so, can I just interject one little thing, partly because I have in mind certain regular viewers who are very skeptical of mindfulness, and I sometimes think they haven't really worked on understanding the various things it can mean. But one of the, I think, ironies, I mean, first of all, as you said, and I think this is your own, as you suggested, and I think this is your own phrase, actually, mindfulness is simple but not easy. It's simple to say it's becoming aware, but as a practical matter, it's not easy. And in the case of being mindful of feelings, which is only one kind of Buddhist mindfulness, but I think a very important part for when it comes to alleviating suffering, there's a kind of irony, which is that you know, we could all say, sure, I'm aware of my feelings. I mean, I know when I'm angry. I know when I'm sad. But there is this irony that as you become more acutely and closely aware of them through meditation, you are less, to put it dramatically, less enslaved by them. To put it less dramatically, less reactive to them. You know, you develop the option of not following their guidance. I mean, if there's this feeling of anxiety that's prompting you to think all these thoughts about how everything's going to go horribly, the more aware you are of the anxiety, this may seem ironic, the closer you get to it, the more you have the option of not following that prompting.
Yeah, and that's a profoundly liberative insight and moment.
Right.
If you can instantiate it, it's liberative because in that moment you realize, and I'm using that word instrumentally in a number of different ways, you actually realize and make real for yourself that you are not that emotion. And you use the word slave. You know, the word for mindfulness in Chinese, I'm going to China on Sunday for 3 weeks. For mindfulness in Chinese is the character for presence or now over the character for heart. And the word for anger, since you brought up anger in Chinese, is the character for slave over the character for heart. So you just nailed that.
Wow.
And you see, this is where like different cultures and different ways of languaging things actually bring out elements of reality that are, you know, incredibly profound. So yes, to come back to what I was saying, catching people falling through the cracks of the healthcare system and challenging them to do something for themselves that no one else could do for them, based on training in these fairly intensive meditative practices and what mindfulness is in my working operational definition, it's the awareness that arises from paying attention on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. Now, you'll notice the definition doesn't say paying attention to what. So it could be anger, if anger arises. It could be your breath, which we know always arises as long as you're on this planet. You're going to be breathing. So, you know, the cliche is you can't leave home without it, but that's very convenient because it means that if you anchor yourself in the present moment with some feature of your body, like breath, then, and the breath is deeply related to emotional reactivity, then already you have a handle on it that you didn't know that you had before. And that expands the repertoire of not just, you know, your capacity to navigate the ups and downs of life, but actually who you are. And so that's the other element of it that we could like investigate at some point. And I know you know, sort of care about this a lot. It's like, you know, you could ask yourself, like, who's angry? I mean, because we're taking a lot of things personally that are not actually personal at all, then making gigantic narratives about them. There are regions in the brain that do this 24/7, and that a little mindfulness can actually attenuate and uncouple
regions
of the brain.
Just to underscore a little this point, that even if you're encountering mindfulness meditation in a therapeutic context, in a context that seems divorced from Buddhism, there are these connections to Buddhist philosophy that you can then follow as far as you want. And you pointed to one of them when you said, you are not the feeling. You know, now there's this famously obscure radical idea in Buddhism called not self. The self in some sense does not exist. Well, what does that mean? Well, if you look at the Buddha's original, earliest foundational discourse on the not self, he goes through the different, what in Buddhism are called aggregates. It's a way of dividing human experience. And he goes through them one by one and says, well, is this
you? Yeah, the five aggregates.
Right. So realizing, and this can be like a dramatic moment in meditation where you view the anxiety and just suddenly it's like you're viewing a piece of abstract art. It's interesting and it's suddenly not painful in the way it was, and you're looking. It's not you.
It's not you.
And if you talk to meditators who have gone further than I have and had, in a deep and ongoing way, this not self experience, they often describe the meditative path, some of them, as, yeah, first I realized that feelings weren't me, and I felt that experientially, and then I did that with thoughts and so on. And so there, I just want to emphasize there is this connection between so-called secular Buddhism, a term neither you nor I loves, and the profoundest parts of Buddhist philosophy.
Yeah, let's call it mainstream Dharma. That's the languaging that I prefer at the moment. It's like it's the mainstreaming of Dharma with a small d. For those of you who are listening, the word Dharma with a capital D is traditionally how the Buddha's actual teachings are described, and he taught for 45 years and kept very careful lab notes, or his lab assistants did. And so there's a huge body of Buddha's teachings, some of which go back quite early. There's Bhikkhu Anilo, his work in early Buddhist meditation, differentiating it from like the Theravadan tradition even, and trying to sort of, by doing textual analysis in Chinese versions of the text, as well as Sanskrit and Pali, look at what the earliest teachings are, because we don't have them. It was an oral tradition at the time of the Buddha.
Right.
So they weren't written down. But the fact of the matter is that the only reason to bring mindfulness into the mainstream is liberation. I would not have started the stress reduction clinic and MBSR just to have a nice little therapy for people. The whole point was that I myself found this to be the most powerful thing that I've ever discovered in my life at that point in time. That's still the case. And if it hadn't been, I'd have moved on to something else. So there's something
by
about
liberation,
this
do you mean liberation from dukkha, from suffering?
Yeah.
Okay.
And yeah, and from a too small version narrative of who you are, which is what the question of is usually translated as not self rather than non-self. Mm-hmm. That we don't want to reify a non-self any more than not self. The notion being that no matter what you investigate in terms of who you are, if you simply start asking yourself that in a cognitive way, you will find that no matter what answers you come up with, it's obvious that that's not completely true. And so the question is like, who's even asking the question? Who's breathing? Who cares? And these are not like, you know, nihilistic perspectives. This is these are doorways into a deeper investigation of that original question, what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm.
And then to recover the full dimensionality of that humanness while we have the chance. And that would be, you know, in part, you know, not so self-centered, so self-preoccupied, mm-hmm. Thinking of oneself as the center of the universe, which of course we all do in a certain way. But then when you train in meditative awareness, something shifts. I mean, there's what I call an orthogonal rotation in consciousness that can come about in an instant. It doesn't necessarily have to be permanent, but you could have it moment by moment by moment, where you're no longer believing your own PR about who you are. And you're actually seeing that when you take your seat to meditate, and I'm talking metaphorically because it doesn't have to be sitting meditation, then actually you're expanding your field of humanness to include others and recognizing that your suffering is no more special than anybody else's suffering. And that gives rise to generosity. It gives rise to a certain kind of kindness. It gives rise to a certain kind of social sensibility that has the potential to actually upgrade how we actually conduct business, how we treat each other, how we treat the planet and so forth. And I think this is kind of urgent. It's like, you know, that the fate of the world might actually hang in the balance of whether as a human species, as we call ourselves Homo sapiens sapiens, which from the Latin sapere, which means to taste or to know, we're the species that knows and knows that it knows. And that is not merely cognition and metacognition. It's really awareness and meta-awareness, at least in my perspective. And so I think that from an evolutionary...
Well, can I just drill down and make sure I understand you? I mean, what level, which of those terms would you say applies to just the average person who is not mindful? I mean, I've heard and I've used metacognition to refer to a kind of aspiration that mindfulness, furthers. In other words, we all do cognition. What we need is the metacognition, the awareness of the way our minds work that allows us to be more judicious in the cognition itself.
Well, you're a philosopher, so you know this stuff far better than I do. But when I hear the word cognition, to me, it really is limited to thinking. And so metacognition virtually has built into it that it's thinking about the process of thinking.
Right.
Whereas awareness includes thinking, but it's a form of intelligence that's much bigger than that, hard to define. And then meta-awareness would be awareness of awareness, which you speak about in your book. So, you know, I know you know this firsthand, but it's like a different quality of intelligence, so to speak. And that's what I'm pointing to, that it's not merely metacognition. That's maybe a first step in the path. To have the thinking process open to that because it makes you more available to experience. But what I'm really pointing to is the awareness function being incredibly special. And that's what I want sapere, Homo sapiens, to actually mean. And I think that Linnaeus actually meant it that way in part, that we're the species that's capable of awareness of our surround and of our interior and of our interconnectedness. And we can also hold that in awareness in ways that actually might regulate how we interact with each other. You know, our impulse to kill each other, for instance, when we dehumanize each other.
So the more mindful you are, the more you approximate meta-awareness.
Exactly.
Okay.
You're living in meta-awareness.
Yeah. Now,
and just to say, it's by the fact that it is awareness rather than cognition, it's de facto, I would say, embodied.
Right.
You practice that, of course. That's what the meditation discipline is about. And just to loop back to something you said at the beginning when I was talking about meditation being simple but not easy, I like to say it's just about the hardest work in the world for us human beings to string even two moments of mindfulness together. It's really, really, really not easy. And that's why you have to exercise a certain kind of muscle of mindfulness and practice. And as you emphasize as well, go on retreat, go into the laboratory and actually explore this when you've simplified the outer world in such a way that you can really zero in on the nature of your own experience.
Yeah, I'm a big advocate of retreats because for one thing, for people like me who just are not naturally good meditators, it may be the only way to get to a point where you appreciate what meditation can do for you.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, you know, although, of course, the way you may feel at the end of a retreat, which can be just transformed, it was with my first retreat, although that's not going to be easy to sustain as you re-enter the world. And maybe the most realistic thing is to hang on to a part of it through a daily practice. And even that's hard. Still, the way you feel at the end gives you, makes it clear to you how far from optimal ordinary human consciousness is and how far from clear it is, how far, you know, how clouded and diluted it is. So even though there's this, you know, possibly frustrating process of the kind of bliss and clarity fading after retreat, and you're realizing I got to work to hang on to some of it, and then maybe I'll recharge with another retreat in 18 months or whatever. It really drives home the point. And to my mind, kind of the truth of the fundamental Buddhist claim, which is the reason we suffer and the reason we make other people suffer is because we don't see the world clearly. You can, the three can go together. You can wind at the end of a retreat. You can literally be seeing things more clearly, your vision less clouded by these emotions and thoughts that mislead you. You can be happier, and you can be behaving better toward people. The three can align.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet, this is where the non-dualism comes in. That is hard to understand, but for me is absolutely fundamental. And that is that it's very easy to reify an end point and say, I'm not a good meditator. And if I did more retreats, or if I was only a better person or less of a curmudgeon or whatever it is, then I would be closer to this idealized end point. And frankly, there's some element of truth to that, but to a large degree, it's also just another fairy tale. It's another narrative. And this is where the Mahayana Chan non-dual Buddhist teachings, I think, are extremely relevant for our day and age.
Which is, as I understand it, the kind of the ancestor of what we think of as Zen, right? I mean, yeah. The Zen became Zen by passing through China.
When it went to Japan. With
Dogen. It wound up in Japan, but there is this Chinese influence, and that is now manifest in Chang, I guess, Buddhism. There was apparently some Taoism flavor added or something.
Yeah, totally.
And your initial training was in Zen.
Yeah.
And I should say, what you're saying, like, there isn't this, don't think of a goal, the ideal. It's totally the standard meditation teacher's thing to say, because it's just valuable. It's, you know, even though on the one hand, I find it useful to think that, you know, and look, let's face it, Buddhism talks about enlightenment. There is this idea of like this optimal state, but at the same time, it can shackle you, your practice. If you
totally.
Think in terms of a goal, there is just this irony that on the one hand, you are sitting down to accomplish something. You want to get somewhere, but thinking about it
and
that way.
No place to, and as it says in the Heart Sutra, you know, the supreme
right.
Mahayana Prajnaparamita teaching,
right.
There's no place to go, nothing to do, and nothing to attain.
Right.
And they're not kidding. And they go through the five skandhas, you know, the five, you know.
Aggregates.
Which has aggregates. And, you know, and they're saying, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Then they said, no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. That's the Four Noble Truths out the window. And you have to understand what this is. It's not an absolute negation. What it is actually a skillful means for pointing out the paradox of this and that, the dualism of wanting to be there when there's no there, it's always here. And so it requires, in some sense, the equivalent of a kind of a atomic or molecular rearrangement of your being in order to sort of realize, as the Zen people would say, like, enlightenment is taking your seat.
Right.
Enlightenment is not some distant thing that if you sit in a cave for 40 years with water dripping on your head, maybe you will attain something.
Well, this gets to the title of that best-selling book of yours, Wherever You Go, There You Are. Right. I mean, when you said there's no there, you already there. And, you know, one thing I appreciated more after having this conversation with you in Louisville is, you know, there's a tendency, I think, on my part to emphasize the meditation. You do the meditation, you'll be better equipped to handle the things you encounter in life. But I think you emphasize rightly the carrying around through your life consciously a philosophy that embodies, you know, what the meditation is for. And a lot of it is captured in this phrase, wherever you go, there you are. In other words, you know, it isn't just that if you're getting angry at a checkout counter and impatient, you can remind yourself to like look at your breath, and then that allows you to stabilize and look at the impatience, and then you come. There is the practice and what it prepares you do, but it's also a matter of carrying around the philosophy in your head to some extent, an approach to life, right?
Yeah, although I myself, you're a philosopher, I wouldn't actually use the word philosophy, and I think we need to develop a new
language.
By the
way, I'm actually not a philosopher technically, PhD-wise. I've taught courses that you could call philosophy courses.
Well, I'm a molecular biologist, PhD-wise, I don't practice it. No, I think the most important part is, in some sense, just recognizing how easily we can turn anything into an ideal and then strive to attain that ideal. And when you flip that on itself, you know, I like to say, you know, in some sense, you are already whole. I mean, that's the root meaning of the word health, healing, and even holy, H-O-L-Y. You're already whole. You're already complete. The only thing that's going to happen is you'll get older, not necessarily any better. There's no better moment than this moment, because it's the only moment we ever actually have. And we're always on the way to some better moment in the future and reacting to what happened in the past. And this is a certain kind of toxicity where, as instead of like holding it as a philosophy, what we're actually, again, realizing, making real, is that we create these fictions in our life. And you write about it in terms of like essence and stuff like that. That we're creating these, and even attribution error and all of those kinds of ways in which we're creating narrative about the people we like and the people we don't like. Tribalism, you know, sort of just coming up through the floorboards of our DNA, so to speak, to mix a few metaphors, because we're not really aware of what it means to actually be embodied in wakefulness in this moment. But the embodied wakefulness is already here. It's like the eyes are already doing it. They're seeing. We don't know how they do it. We can't improve on it. The ears also, of course, it all degrades with age. But what is wrong with us, actually? And when you investigate it, the only thing that's wrong with us is that we're not paying attention to what's salient, to what's most salient, most important. And we're lost in this emotional reactivity and our own narrative and thoughts and stuff like that. And as I was about to say a while ago, these are all instantiated in brain circuitry that, you know, I know you interviewed my colleague, Judd Brewer, who's the head of research at the, you know, Center for Mindfulness now, and now head of the new division of mindfulness in the Department of Medicine, first time on this planet.
This is at the University of Massachusetts, right?
Yes, and the first time ever that a Department of Medicine in any academic medical center anywhere on the planet has formed a division of mindfulness. So, you know, when you think about the confluence of these different, the different domains of science, epistemological domains of science on the one hand, and deep Dharma traditions on the other, deep contemplative practice, it's never happened before on the planet, and the potential richness of it is huge. And whoever is responsible for this flowering, what I hope is that the flowering continues to unfold and really is a certain kind of leads to a renaissance that is a counterbalance to all the tribalism that not only do you mention in your book, but you just open the newspaper any day or look at CNN or any, you know.
It's a great problem.
It's a disease, but it's also part of the nature of the human mind when it doesn't know itself to actually go with greed, to go with hatred, to go with delusion. And we're seeing this played out in spades, but what's the antidote or the alternative to that? It's actually to wake up. And that's why I do the work that I do. And I think that's actually why you do the work you do.
Yeah, no,
And there's no one right way to do it. It's not like if people wake up, they'll be like you. God forbid,
God or be like me. You took the words right out of my mouth.
That. That's why I'm joking about it. But no, the only person, or like the Dalai Lama or Mother Teresa, the only right. person any of us have this a snowball's chance of hell of being like is who we actually are.
Right.
But a lot of the time we live at a distance from who we actually are because we're so caught up in who we think we are or afraid we're not. And that is kind of like walking around with a ball and chain around your ankle and thinking, you know, you're free.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. You know, and I only just thought of this now in hearing you talk. But, you know, as I said, there is this standard meditation teacher instruction. Don't think of there being a goal, this thing you're trying to do through meditation, you want to get there. And I'd always thought, yeah, I mean, the right is a practical matter, because if you think of it that way, it just won't work. And that's enough reason not to do it. But also, and I just kind of realized this oddly, it seems obvious in retrospect, I mean, to just see this thing that you really want is so obviously not what Buddhism, I mean, Buddhism's diagnosis of the problem is that we're always seeing these things we want and trying to grasp them. I mean, I guess I've thought of this connection before, but it is not, I guess I'm saying it's not merely a pragmatically useful teaching that you shouldn't be this goal-oriented in meditation. In a way, this is the heart of Buddhist teaching, is that you shouldn't be goal-oriented, period. I should hasten to add, this doesn't mean that if you meditate, you will no longer
get work done,
your work or anything else. It doesn't work that way, but still, it's you're supposed to quit grasping after things.
Yeah, exactly. And the key word is grasping or craving and clinging. And the Buddha is famous for having said all of his 45 years of teaching could be encapsulated in one sentence. And I like to say, on the off chance he wasn't joking, maybe we should memorize that sentence, because it could come in handy from time to time. And it is this: nothing is to be clung to as I, me, or mine. So the operative verb is clinging. And what's he pointing at? The personal pronouns. And of course we can't speak language without personal pronouns. But when we reify the personal pronouns, and we believe that we know who I am or who me is or what I want, we're in some sense being caught in craving, in greed, or in the opposite of greed, which is aversion, or kind of just the deluded selfing that creates suffering. And when you see that, it's like touching a soap bubble in the present moment. It's like the seeing of it is like a finger touching the soap bubble. It just self-liberates, the Tibetans would say. It goes poof in that moment. Now, that doesn't mean it won't come back and bite you in the butt in the next moment. So you have to train. You have to be on your guard. And it's moment by moment by moment by moment by moment. But since the only time our lives unfold and the only time we can express love or think a thought or be creative or be altruistic is in the present moment, the more the present moment was available for us to inhabit, then the more we actually would be more creative in how we operationalize our lives.
Okay. So I have a book.
And that's the essence of it, as far as I can see, that awareness is, you could think of it. And I think you said this in your book, that you don't like to think of mindfulness as a state, or awareness as a state, or consciousness as a state.
And or enlightenment as a state.
I agree with you. You probably said it about enlightenment.
Yeah,
but I want to say, I really agree with you. And a lot of, you know, it's like one of the things that I like to, you know, tease my neuroscientist friends about, because as scientists, we're trained to think of everything in terms of state. But I prefer to think about mindfulness as a way of being. Maybe if you want, even with a capital W, like the way, you know, of being. Because, and a way of being in relationship. It's relationality, and to what? To experience, inwardly, outwardly, or whatever. But as soon as you reify it as a state, then it's like a desirable thing to attain. And when you fail, if you don't attain it, then you've created this dualism of, it's not here, I have to go there, and I'm no good at going there. And that creates serious problems. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that there's not growth or awakening or realization. It means that that's not what you think either.
Right. So can I ask you a biographical question? So as we've said, although you're famous for this mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is often taught without reference explicitly to Buddhism, you came to your interest in mindfulness through Buddhism. And I think initially you studied in the Zen tradition, as I understand it. And I think we've seen some kind of residue of that in the way you like when you the idea of consciously thinking, you know, like who thinks this thought and so on, that kind of thing. That's a kind of Zen thing. I gather the idea of mindfulness based stress reduction came to you when you were at the Insight Meditation Center, which is also where I've done almost all of my retreats, and you were on retreat. And I know you don't want to over-dramatize the moment as this big epiphany when the sky opened, maybe, but can you just describe what was going on? You were on like what, a week long or 10-day retreat or something? And what was it like when the idea came to you?
Interesting enough, I was just back at IMS leading a 10-day retreat with Bhikkhu Anallo, who is like a really extraordinary Buddhist scholar, very productive, and at the same time, deep practitioner. So, yeah.
And thank you for leaving me a copy of his book in Louisville, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're welcome. And the subject was death, dying, stress, pain, and illness, and how the sort of early Buddhist teachings and the more MBSR perspective actually work together. So, you know, and his point is that the Dharma is continuing to evolve, and that MBSR is in some sense a valid Dharma vehicle or path for certain people. And why not emphasize the positive and then work out all the other stuff? So anyway, to get back to your question, this was in 1979, so 39 years ago. I was on a 2-week retreat at the Insight Meditation Society. Mm-hmm. And at about the 10th day, meditating in my room, and as I said, I've been asking myself for 10 years after my training at MIT and getting my PhD, what the hell am I supposed to actually be doing on this planet with everything that I've been trained to do? And my love for the Dharma. And it came to me in the middle of the afternoon on about the 10th day in a flash that probably didn't last more than 10 seconds, what my job was, what I was supposed to do. I was already working at the UMass Medical Center in the Department of Anatomy and Cell Biology, doing research and teaching gross anatomy to medical students. And I realized that why not create a clinic, as I said before, in the form of a course that would teach people how to take better care of themselves as a complement to whatever benefit they were getting from their more traditional medical treatment, mm-hmm. and base it on as fairly rigorous as I could manage, training in mindfulness meditation or Buddhism without the Buddhism in quotation marks, which you could say is the real Buddhism. I don't want to abandon this from the Dharma perspective, because a lot of people criticize it, saying, well, it's not really Dharma. You've cherry-picked what you like and so forth, and that it's all about relaxation and it's not about liberation. If it weren't about liberation, I never would have done it in the first place. It's like, hey, mindfulness meditation is mindfulness meditation. Who knows what someone can do with it if it's taught appropriately and if people are given permission to understand what it really is instead of a dime store gimmick to just make you feel better for a little while. So in any event, because I was trained as a researcher, I knew this would have no effect in the world whatsoever, except a little anecdotal thing, unless I studied it. So I developed a kind of ongoing, you know, outcome research perspective at first, not having been trained in how to do research on human beings at all. My work was in bacteria and, you know, bacterial viruses and stuff like that, and DNA. And, you know, and it started having profound effects on medical patients virtually from the get-go. And I remember, as if it were yesterday, many of the people in my first year or two of classes and the various diagnoses they came with and how much pain or different medical problems they were suffering with, and how in 8 weeks they were like, you know, in some sense, and it's hard to talk about this because it sounds like I would be exaggerating it, but they would say that things like, you gave my life back to me. And I said, I didn't give you anything. If you got your life back, it's through your own efforts. You were practicing this ability to drop in on the present moment and inhabit your life without your narrative being so operational. And so that was basically how it got started. And then in terms of the research, it just continued to build. And my hope was, and this was part of the original 10-second insight, that if this were successful at UMass, at one hospital, one university academic medical center, and we published a few papers about it, that real scientists who knew how to do this work a lot better than I knew how to do it would get inspired to actually look at this interface between inner experience and training of the mind and attentional faculties and so forth, and the brain, and what we mean when we use the word health and healing and wellness. And that's in fact what happened. And now if you look at the graph of the number of papers per year in the medical and scientific literature that are coming out of mindfulness, it went along at a very low level for 15 to 20 years. And then around 1998, it started to go up, up, up. And now it's going straight up. Mm-hmm. And it's like 700 or 800 papers a year. So it's created a whole field within medicine, neuroscience, psychiatry, psychology, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And now education is moving out into all sorts of other domains. And this was, in some sense, all an aspiration, because I don't feel like it was me doing it so much as the Dharma doing itself when you take away some of the obstacles to it.
Right. So about this, this 10-second insight at the Insight Meditation Society, as it happens, two questions, and maybe you mentioned this, but if so, I missed it. Were you at that moment doing sitting meditation or walking meditation or none of the above? And also
meditation in my room.
You were doing sitting meditation in your room, and it kind of came to you. And did it just seem so obviously the right thing to do that you basically never doubted it from then to when you really started doing it?
Yeah. And I talked to people about it. And, you know, of course, to operationalize something like that without any credentials, I mean, nothing like that had ever been done before. And so the medical center could ask, well, who are you to do that? You know, you've never had a course in psychology, never mind training in medicine. And now you want to open a medical clinic. And to tell you the truth, there's no explaining how it happened. It's just the only thing I can say is it's like, you know, karma. Mm-hmm. But I managed to have had the right preconditions, MIT, you know, what all of that stuff together in some sense, and my training in meditation in the various traditions, the Insight tradition, the Zen tradition, and then later Tibetan Dzogchen and so forth, which I'm still pursuing. It somehow all just came together. And part of the insight was, in those 10 seconds, was this would be a phenomenal right livelihood for many, many meditators who really, you know, have to do other kind of work to be able to continue on their own self-liberative path.
That is one of the eight factors on the eightfold path, right livelihood. You know, you're choosing a vocation that is, in some sense, right.
Yeah, in alignment with wisdom and non-harming.
Right.
So building munitions, for instance, or being an arms manufacturer or seller would be the kind of quintessential wrong livelihood, so to speak, with all of those karmic consequences which would be attendant to it.
Okay, so we're almost out of time, but let's fast forward now to the present. I'm curious as to where you see the most progress, the most opportunity, maybe the most challenge. I just wrote a piece in Wired that appeared a couple of days ago where at the end I said if I could do one thing to solve the world's problems, it would be to teach mindfulness meditation in public schools. And I know some of these initiatives are going
on. That's happening yeah. Big time.
Is it?
In public schools. It is. And, to loop back to something you said earlier, it was challenged in California, in Escondido, I think, by a parent who thought that, you know, their child was being, taught, Buddhism or something. And then yoga even made it worse because that would be Hinduism. And they hired a right-wing law firm that actually I think, read all of my papers and books infinitely more thoroughly than any other group of people ever on the planet, and quoted it in a 27-page document that they fired across the bow of the school system and so forth. And I read the document, and every single thing that I said was true and completely misinterpreted. And I'll give you one example. And this is why I think it's, you said it's better not to use the word Buddhism when you're dealing with schools and stuff like that. But since everybody knows that mindfulness come out of Buddhism, I don't think that's actually going to be very effective. I think you need to have a strategy of what you might call a preemptive engagement and say, look, there's no question that the most refined articulation of mindfulness comes out of the Buddhist tradition. But the Buddha himself wasn't a Buddhist. This is not about Buddhism. This is about paying attention and the awareness that arises from paying attention. And it's basically universal and it's basically human.
Right.
And I think it's fair to make those arguments. I think it's possible to make those arguments in really good ways. And that then people say, oh, okay, because it's like, you know, who wouldn't benefit from doing yoga if you didn't think they were trying to make a Hindu out of you or a radical extremist Hindu out of you or something like that? It's just about your body on the floor or standing on your head or whatever it is. But it's like, what particular benefit would it have? And you don't need to adopt any belief system around it. So that's the orientation, so to speak.
Okay. Well, that's
I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, no, you did. I mean, I'm just happy to hear that there is progress on this front. I think it's so important that you've thought about ways to facilitate it.
And you know, the reason it's happening is because teachers can't teach in the classroom anymore in public schools. They're desperate for, you know, you can't yell at the class to pay attention, but you could teach them how. And that might be more important than anything in the curriculum, is if you teach young kids how to be embodied in their own awareness and intention and to not be dissed by what anybody else says, because they've learned at a young age not to take what other people throw at you as personal.
Right.
That's more important than whether you're good at algebra or math or, you know, anything else. And I think the teachers are so desperate, and the kids are coming to school now in many, many school systems where they're not ready to learn. And a lot of them have experienced trauma that morning and they haven't had breakfast either. And so the teachers are carrying an awful lot. And it's not like mindfulness is the answer to all life's problems, but it does, in fact, offer some kind of a final common pathway into our humanity in a way that I think leads to other ways of incorporating what's good and beautiful in our society to work together for the common good.
Okay. And finally, is there any aspect of your work that we haven't mentioned that you want to call attention to? Any books, any website, any, you know, where should people go if they want to find out more about what you do?
JonKabat-Zinn.com is my website. And, you know, I'm coming out with four new books that are basically dividing up of my big book Coming to Our Senses from 15 years ago, updating it and coming out with four volumes, the first of which is out already, called Meditation Is Not What You Think, Mindfulness and Why It's So Important. I'm looking at it right here. Mm-hmm. And those will be coming out over the course of the rest of this year. But basically what is most exciting to me is that underneath all the hype around mindfulness, which we really haven't talked about, and whenever anything enters the mainstream like this, of course, it's going to get hyped. It's going to be exploited by people who can't even spell the word mindfulness, never mind know what it is or know the word Dharma. But I think this is a risk that's worth taking, because the Dharma in its depth with a small d is something that is so potentially valuable to our evolution as a species on this planet at a very, very fragile time in the development of us. And we're only, you know, 600 or 800 generations of a species since the last, you know, the end of the last ice age. So that's not a lot of generations. All of human history has unfolded within then. But we have now weapons that our tribalism now is like, you know, I've reached a level of, you know, proportion that we need to recruit what's best about ourselves and deepest in ourselves so to manage all of our anger and othering that's going on. So I think social justice is an unavoidable byproduct, so to speak, of waking up to the actuality of what it means to be human, because we realize that we project onto others their own, you know, sort of, we miss who they actually are because of our own prejudices, fears, lenses for seeing things the way we want to see them. And this is, again, to loop back to your book. I mean, you talk a lot about tribalism. It's one of the things that I really appreciated about our conversation when we were in Louisville, that this is the issue of our time, and we're seeing it played out in Congress to sort of despicable proportions. And we're seeing it played out in China. We're seeing it played out in Russia. I mean, that, like, everything's moving towards 1984, only it's way past 1984, but those kinds of dictatorships, so to speak. And I think that, you know, we're at a point where the species is really being challenged. And if, as I said, if I'd seen anything more powerful than what mindfulness represents to me, I'd be doing that. But I haven't seen anything like that. And I think that it will pull in what's deepest and best in all of our humanity. And together, we'll all be able to contribute to something much bigger.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much, John, for taking the time. This is the second conversation I've had with you, and I've gotten so much out of both of them. And I want to thank
you. Well, for me, too.
I want to thank you on behalf of humankind, although I know you're too modest probably to accept the thanks. So we'll stipulate when I thank you that you are merely a vehicle for the Dharma.
Thank you.
But you're a great one. And so Godspeed with all your work.
Well, thank you.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Meaning of Life TV. Meaning of Life will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Meaning of Life programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.